It's a freedom machine like no other. Starting, growing, and cashing out of your own business.
Then all hell breaks loose.
Burned out, carrying all the weight on your shoulders, fighting fire after fire, never getting a break. But that was so yesterday.
It's time for your business breakthrough. Break out of the bottleneck. Break through to new levels of success. And break into a life you love. Now from Park Avenue in New York City, here's attorney, strategist, and SBA small business champion, Nina Kaufman. This is the Business Breakthrough Podcast.
Hello, how are you? Welcome to Business Breakthrough. I'm your host, Nina Kaufman, coming to you from the heart of New York City, and I'm glad you're here today. Thanks for tuning in. In this episode, we're going to chat with Jane Friedman. She's a business attorney and angel investor about, do you want manageable or scalable? Now think about it. When you've reached that point of frustration, you ever say to yourself, oh, I just want this to be manageable. And sometimes what that means is we want to take it all back, have it all on our plate so we can control it all. But you know what? We're never going to grow that way. And it reminds me of the image of a plant in a pot. Now, I'll tell you, I have a black thumb, so anything that I try to grow, just, it is a mess. Other than a business, let me put in that caveat right there. But when you think about a plant that you put in a pot, imagine a small terracotta pot. You've got your plant, you have the soil, and you start to water it, and the plant grows, and it grows, and it grows. Well, the roots need to go somewhere, don't they? If a plant is going to grow, the more it grows upwards, it also grows downwards. But if you have a pot that's too small for the roots, what happens? Well, the roots start to grow up and around the base of the plant, and ultimately, it chokes it. So maybe the pot keeps the plant manageable because you don't want roots sprawling all over your home, but eventually, that plant is going to die. It's got to be transplanted into something bigger, either a bigger pot or outdoors into the soil, or it's going to wither and die. And sometimes our businesses are like that too. That if you don't transplant it into something bigger, if you keep it all on you and your shoulders, there's no more room for it to grow. And why I wanted to bring Jane on today is that she was at the same place that many of us have been too, that place of manageable, but what do you do? And, you know, there are fears and concerns about growing. But she found a way to break through. And that's why I'm looking forward to talking with her this week. So a little bit about Jane before we start. Jane Friedman is the founder and principal of Jane Friedman Law, LLC. She runs a full-service business law firm in the Boston area that helps companies navigate legal matters so they can make intelligent and profitable business decisions while reducing their risk. She's an angel investor whose blogs have been published by the Boston Globe and is a frequent speaker and conference panelist. Jane was voted a super lawyer for 2015, and she serves on several nonprofit boards addressing domestic violence and cancer patients. Near and dear to my heart is that we are both alums of the same college, Wellesley College in Wellesley, Massachusetts, and we are delighted to have her here on Business Breakthrough. Hello, Jane. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Nina.
One of the things that I wanted us to talk about, and I'm so excited for you and your law practice, is that you reached a point where you were really at capacity. And you found a way to break through. I know a lot of small business owners, they'll reach capacity and then they'll kind of shrink back and say, let me see if I can become more efficient with automation or maybe take on less or keep it manageable. So can you tell us a little bit about that decision point of, do I keep it manageable or do I want more? And what tipped you
sure.
into more? So bring us to that place.
Yeah, sure. No, it was definitely, you know, a big decision for me. I had, you know, sort of started the practice thinking that I would keep it, you know, just me and more manageable. And then, as you said, about 3 or 4 months into it, it seemed like I could actively manage it to keep it sort of, you know, smaller and more manageable, or I could really take that big leap and see where I could go with it. And so I, you know, I guess one of my mantras is, you know, like, you know, why do it small when you can do it big? So I decided to take that leap and have been really happy with the decision. But in terms of scaling, I created a business model for the firm that is really scalable up or down, depending on what projects we're working on and how busy we are, frankly. I started by sort of putting out the word in various networks, legal networks that I am a part of, seeking subject matter expertise in the various areas that the firm was, you know, getting reach outs for projects and handling projects. And I created this network of service providers, contractors, that I could rely on, you know, folks who have been practicing for quite a long time. And either I, you know, they had worked for me or with me in past jobs or past lives, or they were people that I had just sort of met along the path, along my way of setting up the firm, who had no interest in working full time, but were really happy to take on, you know, project work. And that has worked extremely well. I would also say that I did a significant amount of sort of market research, if you will, as mm-hmm. I was creating this business model to really understand, you know, what am I going up against in terms of providers of legal services, both big firms, small firms, solos, et cetera, you know, how those folks are marketing themselves and how they're pricing and getting projects and things like that. And I also spent a lot of time examining what I call the temporary market for legal services. So there are a lot of temp agencies. What are they doing in terms of placing attorneys? How are they paying their attorneys? How are, you know, companies and firms paying for these attorneys to create a business model that worked really well for me and for my lawyers who work for me? Because I, you know, first and foremost, I want them to feel valued and like they're being treated more than fairly. So that was it in a nutshell.
That's great. So I want to jump back to you. First, you said you have a mantra, why do it small when you can do it big? Where did that come from?
Oh, you know, some recess of my brain. I've always been one of those people who set kind of lofty goals for myself. I like to challenge myself, and some I reach and some I don't or haven't. Yeah. And I'm also one of those people who needs to be probably overwhelmed. You know, the busier I am, the better, the more balls I have in the air, the more efficiently I work, and really the happier I am, although, you know, friends and family might say that I definitely complain from time to time about how busy I am. But I just find that, you know, kind of spurs me on and gives me the adrenaline to just do more and achieve more. And so when I, you know, first set up the practice and I was, you know, meeting with some success on my own, more and more, you know, over time, obviously. But, you know, I was sort of like, huh, you know, for an example, I really like to do mergers and acquisitions. Mm-hmm. And that's not a kind of legal work that lends itself to a solo practice. So I, you know, went into my head and said, how can I set up Jane Friedman Law to handle that kind of work, but not full time? And, you know, so that was a piece of it. What are the kinds of projects that I want to be doing and want to be taking on? And how can I position myself and the firm to do that in a way that, you know, makes sense for me and the firm and clients. And so again, when I, you know, was sort of like, ho-hum, you know, I love working with small businesses. I love, you know, the kind of work that I'm doing myself, but the leverage that was available to me if I sort of expanded and really tried to market the firm as a firm and not just as a me solo, you know, the possibilities seemed endless, and it was just too juicy to not put it out there and see, you know, see what the possibilities were. And like, again, in my head, I was like, so what? Like, what's the worst thing that could happen? I fail miserably and whatever, I go apply for jobs. Oh, well.
That's great. I mean, some might call you an adrenaline junkie and others might just say you are ambitious. So beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So you touched on something interesting in that the providers that you've aligned yourself with don't necessarily have an interest in working full time. What are some of the other things going on in their lives that made this kind of arrangement attractive for them and for you?
There is this amazing and big untapped market of expertise and legal resources that I discovered when I first set up my firm as a solo. Now, to backtrack a tiny bit, I have been in sort of big corporate America for 18 years. I was at a big firm when I started practicing, and then I was at two very large public companies. And so the strata, that's not probably the right word, but the layer of legal services that I moved in was really, you know, using really big firms and interacting with, you know, with big firms on the other side of the table or a big company on the other side of the table. And so I, you know, while I had some experience representing smaller companies, I just more and more had like gravitated to, by necessity, I guess, because of the jobs that I was in, those bigger providers. And sure. So when I struck it on my own, it was really eye-opening to see that there's this, you know, you sort of get this, or I got this very narrow view of, oh, you know, the only good lawyers are the lawyers at the big Wall Street firms or the big Boston firms. And, you know, that is obviously not the case, but those were the folks I was interacting with on a regular basis. So, you know, it was eye-opening and amazing to find that there is just this whole layer of really talented practitioners who, you know, maybe they're moms and they decided to leave the big law track to stay home and raise their kids, but they're super smart and have a lot to offer, and maybe they can give me an hour a week. Or maybe, you know, it's somebody who, you know, maybe didn't choose to step off the corporate track, but that choice was made for them. They've explored other things, but they still, again, have this sort of bulk of legal expertise in a specialty area that I need once in a while. And again, that, you know, that person's available to me and really thrilled to help. And then there are other practitioners who are more what I would call a career type. Either they're solos who are doing legal work full time or trying to do legal work full time. And again, have expertise, but haven't sort of figured out the business development and the marketing piece of the business, I think, in the way that I think about it. And so they have capacity and willingness to pitch in and, you know, do work for me as well. So it's, you know, it comes from a variety of places. But folks sort of know that I'm doing this. And so they've made introductions to me of people who, again, for, you know, whatever reason or whatever they found their personal circumstances to be, you know, are really excited and interested in being a part of what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. And what made you choose the route of contractors instead of employees?
It's a really good question. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I'm going to be a little cagey, you know, being a lawyer and a business lawyer, I very much am cognizant of the federal and state rules governing contractors versus employees. So I wouldn't necessarily counsel another business, you know, to do what I've done. And it's so fact specific, but in, you know, in my view, I'm using very experienced practitioners who've got, you know, as many years of practice under their belts as I do, or in some cases a lot more. And so the projects that I'm giving them, you know, it's really like they're kind of off and doing the work on their own. And in some cases, even interacting with my clients without a lot of control or supervision, you know, they're using their own resources, laptop, et cetera, to do the work. So, you know, in my legal opinion and my, you know, my business opinion, it just was the model that, you know, made sense for me. I think that over time, I may need to reevaluate that depending on where the firm goes and the business goes. Sure. And if it continues to ramp up, then, you know, perhaps I'd have a different view. But for now, I think it is working quite well.
And that's always the curious thing about being the business owner is just because you put something in place for now doesn't mean that there isn't a better or more efficient or, I don't want to say more legal, but more appropriate way for things to shift and change as your business changes and grows over time.
Yeah, definitely. That's one of the things I love about having my own business is I can, you know, my friend Sue always says, it's like spaghetti, throw it on the wall and see what sticks. And I love that because, you know, you can try something and if it doesn't work, you stop doing it and try something else. So that serves me well.
Great. So I'm curious, and one of the things that I know is often a block for small business owners is how do I know someone is the right person and that time and effort and energy and hope invested in a new team member for them not to work out can be really devastating. So what are some of the questions that business owners should ask in exploring these kinds of arrangements? What were the things that you asked? And was there anything you wish you had explored but didn't?
Great question, Nina. When I meet with potential contractors for my business, I interview them just like I'd be interviewing them were I, you know, a general counsel hiring for my legal department or were I a hiring partner at a big firm. So I, you know, study their resume and their background and experience and skills. And I think about whether I think there could be a match with the types of projects that the firm works on. And again, I meet with them in person and conduct, you know, talk to them in the way that I would conduct a job interview. And then, you know, beyond that, when a project comes up and I try them out, you know, I try to be really open and direct and transparent and give them sort of feedback along the way. If something isn't working or if something isn't, you know, to my liking or to my standards, mm-hmm. I'll offer that feedback. And ultimately, you know, have I made some wrong turns or have, you know, sure. I mean, I've definitely worked with folks who I might say, well, I'm not really sure I'd work with them again for a variety of reasons. And so I have that flexibility, you know, to be like, okay, well, you know, this is great and thank you, but not mm-hmm. necessarily go into detail of, you know, oh, you did a terrible job on this, or, you know, which, you know, hasn't been the case, but, if, you know, were that to be the case, I think I would just say thank you and move on, unless the person truly was interested in learning and wanted, you know, detailed constructive feedback. I'm always happy to mentor and do that, so.
Okay. As you got more proficient in screening people, are there questions that you realize now that maybe you should have been asking at the outset or things that you should have been or wish you had been looking into that you just didn't know until they came up?
That is a great question. And yes, I think two things that, you know, I've learned is that sometimes it's not enough to simply conduct an interview and ask somebody what their skills and experience are and how that lends itself to working with me, but to actually see their work. And so, you know, asking for a work sample or, you know, something along those lines, I think can be really helpful. The other question that I started to ask, or rather that I should ask, because I don't believe I've interviewed or taken on a new contractor since this light bulb went off. But like, what else does the person have going on in their life? And is this something that they really want to do? Because at the end of the day, I'm managing a firm and numerous projects and client deadlines. And my, you know, number one priority is to deliver stellar legal service to my clients. Part of that, of course, is having my contractors provide me with their work product or their assignment, you know, timely. So
yeah.
When you, right, like that's basic, right? But often these folks, you know, like maybe there's a reason they don't have a full-time job. And maybe, you know, and I'm not saying that in a like these people aren't good lawyers way. I'm saying it in a, they might have a sick parent or a child who has some, you know, issues that require attention or, you know, maybe they're getting married. Like anything and everything could be going on in their lives that is more important than Jane Friedman Law. And so having that conversation up front, I think, is going to be really valuable for me so that I don't get frustrated, you know, when I give somebody an assignment and then I don't get it back when I think I'm going to, or it's not in the form that I want, you know, whatever the issue is. Maybe I'm more anticipating that more, or a little more prepared for that.
Mm-hmm. Great. So as you're planning to expand, clearly there are going to be some what I'll call infrastructure additions that you need to be aware of in terms of taking that on. What were some of the things that, oh, now that you're managing a team, you have these additional expenses where you might not have had them before?
That's a great question. I try to keep my expenses as low as possible. And one of the ways I do that is by not having an office. We're all virtual. I don't purchase computer, you know, components for my contractors. I don't provide them with, you know, research databases or tools to get their job done. I expect that they bring those with them. I have a computer, you know, a system set up, a platform, if you will, that allows us all, you know, and it's very straightforward and simple. It's Google Mail, but we all have Jane Friedman Law email addresses so that when we're corresponding with each other and with clients, it's, you know, seamless. But that's really it. I mean, I'm not kidding you. Like, I've made some investments for myself in terms of, you know, getting my work done and managing the firm. But those aren't necessarily investments that I've shared across my contractors. And again, I think that's one of those things that I will absolutely need to re-examine as and if the firm continues to grow and I say, gosh, I maybe need to have some employees, either part-time or full-time. Do I need to have an office? Is there more infrastructure that I need to gain further efficiencies to, you know, allow us to continue to deliver that legal service to clients?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also the more of the tools that you provide to the contractors, the less they start looking like contractors. So that
exactly
may be
my point.
Another reason as well. But there, I think you did mention when we were talking earlier that you did have higher, let's say, malpractice insurance premiums or things like that. So it's just to identify for our listeners that bringing on someone can involve some more expenses. So you just want to be able to factor that in. And I raise that because of this next question, which is calculating your fees. Now that you have a team and it's not just you doing the work, what's the process you went through for deciding your fees so you can ensure, yes, a healthy profit margin for you, but also a fair fee for the contractor who's working with you?
Oh, you want my secret sauce?
Yeah. Don't need the numbers.
No, I mean, you'll laugh because as I mentioned earlier in the conversation, I did, when I decided to kind of, you know, go big or go home, I did a ton of market research on what are other solos, you know, similarly situated practitioners charging clients. How are they doing pricing? Is it flat fee or is it hourly or is it a hybrid? I also looked at small firms. I also looked at big firms because I'm a corporate lawyer. And so I thought to myself, well, you know, it's possible. Sometimes I could be going up against a bigger firm for you know, a project. And then, like I said, I also looked on the expense side at the temp market and how much the temp agencies charge for temp attorneys. What's the going rate, you know, again, like for my sort of guys and women who are solos, but not necessarily sort of looking at it how I'm looking at it. What do they charge per hour for their services? Are there ways to gain, you know, are there ways to sort of do business with these folks that, again, is mutually beneficial for me, for them, and the client? And so I set up a pricing structure that I thought would, you know, provide me with some margin and some leverage while also, again, being sort of more than fair to my contractors and my clients. And so I set my hourly rate and the hourly rates of my my contractors at a level that I think is highly competitive based on sort of the other practitioners that they might be considering working with. I offer a lot of flexibility in billing for my clients. We do a lot of work flat fee. And again, I've refined that over time. But when I started out, I sort of looked at how long I thought it was going to take to do something. And then I tracked it against how long it actually took to do something. And, sort of figured out like the over-under on that one and then what my expenses were going into it. And then on the contractor side, I pay my contractors hourly, again, more than fairly. I pay them substantially more than they would get paid from like a temp agency. And again, I think I mentioned that some of these folks, are fine practitioners, but not necessarily great at business development, nor do they want to be. So from that perspective, I offer them a way to be earning a more than fair wage and doing some nice, interesting work, in a way that I think they wouldn't be able to do, without partnering with me or somebody like me. So there was a lot of research done, but at the end of the day, I sort of went with my gut. I'm not very scientific. So I did all this research and then I was like, let's just see what the market will bear. And so I did, and people responded really well, and, it's been off to the races. And now I will say there are times when, particularly on the client side, as I'm sure, you probably experienced this too, or, maybe you're lucky enough not to, clients want to negotiate my fees. I'm very sympathetic, especially to the startup, because I understand their situation. But I've also learned over time that that can be a red flag. And so I'm usually not particularly interested in negotiating my fees. Again, I will do a lot of things flat fee, and I can be really flexible with that because I sort of, again, know what my secret sauce is and where the pressure points are. But at the end of the day, I think our rates are really fair and we give good value for those rates. And again, that's been refined over time. I would have had a very different answer 2 years ago.
Yeah. And certainly the issue of how do you price and negotiating with clients could be an entirely different conversation. But I was curious, again, from that business scale perspective, because it's not just enough to say, oh, great, I have an option to provide a wider range of service if you're not able to do it profitably. So that's why I'm really glad you were able to speak to both of those issues, the scaling and the profitability. And as we wrap, give us a before and after shot. What was the range of what you were able to do as a solo, and how has that expanded and scaled since you've stepped into this new business model?
Well, that's a great question. When I started out, I was doing projects that were 100% within my area of expertise and my sort of my comfort zone. So for example, basic corporate structuring work, contracts, things like that. As I expanded, I realized, gosh, every new company, more or less, has something to trademark. I understand at a very high level the strategic reasons behind that and a little bit of the law. But I'm not a trademark attorney. I don't do trademark filings, for example. So right away, I was like, oh, here's an area where I could really use somebody with that expertise. Commercial leasing is another area where I've certainly negotiated lots of commercial leases before. I managed from a legal perspective the real estate work at my prior company. But it's not my area of expertise. I don't do it all the time, and it's much more cost effective for me to work with lawyers who only do that kind of work and are interested in, this kind of a project arrangement. So I as clients were coming to me and I was recognizing that their needs were more than just general corporate and recognizing what those areas were in which they were likely to need expertise, I started forming my quote team, if you will. And then I think I mentioned earlier in our conversation, from a transactional perspective, even for a small transaction, a deal quote deal team is key because issues are going to come up. Again, there may be a commercial real estate issue, there may be some intellectual property issues, the employment issues. And so having those resources available to provide that seamless legal service to the client, to me, was key and critical to being successful at it.
Well, Jane, I appreciate all your insights regarding the ways that you've created more leverage in your business and how you've moved from manageable to scalable. So thank you so much for the detail and really the transparency that you've shared about how you've been building your business. So thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, Nina, thank you so much for inviting me. This has been lots of fun.
And thanks to you for tuning in today. You know, I really want you to have a breakthrough in your business as well. So as a loyal listener, I want to give you free access to one of my special video trainings that I call Ignite. In this Ignite webinar, I share my quick growth scale formula that lets you bust through the plateau, design a self-sustaining business, and live the life you deserve. You can get free access by going to businessexponential.com/BBIgnite. Again, that's businessexponential.com/BBIgnite. Go there now, and we'll see you on the next episode of Business Breakthrough.